From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Director Bill Forsyth's quirky films put Scotland on the map of world cinema. Those films include Gregory's Girl, Local Hero, and Comfort and Joy. On this edition of Fresh Air, Forsyth tells us about his new film, Breaking In. It has a screenplay by John Sayles and stars Burt Reynolds as an aging burglar. Also, we meet Dmitry Nabokov, son of the late novelist Vladimir Nabokov. He's just edited a collection of his father's letters. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of a new David Bowie CD collection. And Owen Gleiberman looks at a martial arts film now out on home video. It's called Bloodsport, and it stars Jean-Claude Van Damme, the successor to Bruce Lee. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The Bush administration today mounted a defense against growing criticism of its handling of Tuesday's failed coup attempt in Panama, saying there was no opportunity to seize General Manuel Noriega and that the use of American force was not warranted. But he added that he wouldn't rule out any option, including military intervention, in any future coup attempt. The Senate today rejected a bipartisan plan to save core benefits of Medicare catastrophic illness insurance while cutting the controversial income-based surtax. The defeat leaves the Senate facing two choices: to eliminate the surtax and more benefits, or to join with the House in scuttling the program outright. By a 62-37 vote, the Senate rejected a proposal by Senator David Duernberger that would have cut the surtax and monthly fee used to finance the program. In Chicago, a federal jury found author Seymour Hersh innocent in a libel suit filed by a former prime minister of India. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
The jury deliberated for less than a day after closing arguments in the case brought by Morarji Desai, the 94-year-old Indian leader who sued Hersh for $100 million. In his 1983 book, The Price of Power, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author wrote that Desai was a paid informant for the Central Intelligence Agency, who influenced U.S. policy toward India and Pakistan in the early 1970s. Earlier this week, Desai's attorneys called former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger to the witness stand in an effort to refute that claim. But the jury decided in favor of Hersh, who testified that several sources corroborated his information about Desai. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
Israel's inner cabinet today rejected an Egyptian invitation for talks in Cairo with Palestinians. Chris Hedges of the Dallas Morning News reports.
When the 12-member inner cabinet split down party lines, the proposal was, because of cabinet regulations, rejected. Foreign Minister Moshe Arens asked labor ministers to delay the vote until he could get a written clarification of a new U.S. compromise proposal from Washington. But labor leaders, although they knew they could not carry their motion, called for a vote anyway. It was unclear why labor wanted to hold a vote rather than wait on the American proposal. The U.S. proposal offers to arrange a meeting between U.S., Israeli, and Egyptian officials to discuss the makeup of a Palestinian delegation. A State Department spokesman in Washington said that regardless of the vote, the U.S. was still engaged in active diplomacy. For National Public Radio, this is Chris Hedges in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 11 points to close at 2785.52. Advances led declines on volume of 173 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 17 cents. This is NPR News. President Bush underwent what the White House says was entirely successful surgery to remove a cyst from the middle finger of his right hand today. The president declared afterward that all is well. In a statement released later at the White House, spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the minor surgery on the president was uneventful, and though a pathological exam of the cyst, and less than half an inch long, has not yet been done, doctors indicate the cyst appears benign. In Japan, Prime Minister Toshiki Kaifu was guaranteed another term as prime minister today. He was the only candidate nominated to become president of the ruling party later this month. With no opposition, Kaifu will remain president and prime minister. Spencer Sherman reports from Tokyo.
Kaifu's unopposed candidacy means he'll remain prime minister for 2 years, or as long as the Liberal Democrats have a majority in the lower house of parliament. For the first time in nearly 35 years, the LDP's future is in doubt because of a series of scandals that have caused the party's popularity to plummet. Kaifu replaced Sosuke Uno 2 months ago when Uno resigned in a sex scandal, and Uno had replaced Nobuo Takeshita earlier this year after Takeshita was forced out for financial misdealings. In his short time in power, Kaifu has promised to reform the party, and polls show the public is responding to his message. Kaifu is hoping now to stall a showdown in lower house elections until his party's popularity is restored. The opposition is pressing hard for an early election. The lower house election must be held before July. For National Public Radio, I'm Spencer Sherman in Tokyo.
Government officials said today that an audit has uncovered widespread Interior Department mismanagement of an Indian trust fund, including the unexplained disappearance of $17 million and other losses because of sloppy record-keeping. The losses were brought to light by an Inspector General's investigation into the Bureau of Indian Affairs Management of the trust fund. I'm Frank Stasio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bill Forsyth's first feature film was also Scotland's first feature film. It was the 1979 movie That Sinking Feeling. It cost $10,000, and it starred unemployed teenagers from a Glasgow youth center. Forsyth continues to live in Scotland, and although his movies have become more ambitious, they've remained offbeat. His movies, which have played in the U.S., include Gregory's Girl, Local Hero, Comfort and Joy, and Housekeeping. Forsyth has just completed his first film for a Hollywood studio. It's called Breaking In, and it stars Burt Reynolds as an aging burglar who breaks into safes for a living. He takes on a flaky young apprentice who breaks into houses for kicks. The screenplay is by John Sayles. Breaking In is the first film Forsyth directed that he didn't write.
Although writing and directing is still, you know, the prime thing that I want to do, I've become a little less precious about, you know, working with other people's material.
Mm-hmm.
Because no matter what you do, someone like me, you know, taking on someone else's script, I would never just kind of leave it the way it was and turn up and, on the day and shoot it. So I think over the, you know, the months between taking on the project and filming it, I had, you know, managed to put my own stamp on it. Mm-hmm. And that was something that John Sayles was quite sensitive about, because being a writer-director himself, one of the first things he said to me was that if you do this, I'll leave you alone. You know, I won't kind of burden you with my interpretation of it. You know, I'll just hand it over and let you go on with it. And that's what he did.
Mm-hmm. Burt Reynolds gives a terrific performance in the movie as a burglar in his early 60s. Now, he's usually thought of as a macho hero of formula action films. Why did you want to use him? What did you see in him?
It's difficult to kind of verbalize, but to my mind, these are the kind of things that I mentioned his name very early on in the casting procedure, and I had quite a hard job even then explaining why I was interested in him, but I just was, and I suppose it's only in retrospect that I can begin to piece together why I was interested in him. First of all, there's quite a limited choice of actors of that age group. There are quite a lot on the basis that the financiers wanted someone who had a reputation and a name. You know, there's not a kind of unlimited amount of actors of his generation available who have, you know, good reputations and kind of box office reputations. So that was the first thing that kind of limited the choice immediately. But he was certainly my first choice among the actors who qualified and who were of the right age. And as I say, I'm just beginning to piece together why now. I think the fact that he is a very kind of physical performer and has a persona as a physical actor, benefited this particular character in the sense that it's someone who is beginning to realise the limitations of his lifespan, and he's beginning to lose his capacity to, you know, be physical, and he's a criminal who's kind of at the end of his career. He can't run up and down buildings the way he used to 10 years before, and he's almost like a kind of adolescent old man. He's someone who is just beginning to realise he's beginning to realise that there's more behind him than there is in front of him.
Did you have to work hard to convince him to do the movie?
Yes, in some ways, yes. He was obviously resistant to the idea of playing someone older than himself, but I suppose that's just a normal actor's vanity. But once we had overcome that, he kind of put himself into it full tilt, to the extent of spending, you know, like 2 hours every morning in the makeup truck, going through the aging process. And that was we were shooting in Portland in last summer, which sometimes on the street we had temperatures of 110, and and Bert was wearing virtually a full latex makeup mask, and it was very painful to watch him. You know, when the sweat built up underneath the latex, having to cope with it. And at the end of the day, when we shot the last scene, he would tear off this plastic face with great joy.
I was wondering if you wish that you were able to get someone who you liked as much as Reynolds, who was a little bit older and wouldn't have had to wear appliances and latex makeup, if you feared it might become a bit of a stunt, getting someone who was younger and had to make up to look older.
It didn't really worry me, because, I always perceived of Bert being much nearer the character in question than he did.
which I bet you didn't tell him.
No. I think we're all allowed our vanities, you know, so... But certainly it made him more comfortable, you know, going through the aging process, and it made him more comfortable in the part. But as I say, I think we had the benefits of the fact that it was someone who was resisting old age, if you like, because that was very much the character. As I was saying earlier, it was someone who was just beginning to feel the first twinges of mortality, and so it was actually quite beneficial to the character to have that kind of in the background anyway.
Bill Forsyth is my guest, the director of Local Hero, Housekeeping, Comfort and Joy, and a new movie called Breaking In, which stars Burt Reynolds. Now, I have to tell you, I saw a morning screening of Breaking In. The night before, someone tried to break into the trunk of my car. And so I was there with a car with where the trunk was kind of useless. And I come to your movie, and in the first scene, there's Burt Reynolds trying to break the lock of someone's house to get in. And I had a really interesting reaction to it. It's the first time I've seen a movie right after an attempt at crime was was made against me. And I found myself really identifying with two criminals in this, you know, with their frustration, with their sense of an alternate life, you know, with, I think we all identify with feelings of marginality, no matter how marginalized we are in real life. But at the same time, I felt like the victim. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, yeah. Well, it was a preoccupation of mine making the movie, that I didn't want to sentimentalize the criminals to the extent that that people liked them and forgot what they were actually doing, because
yeah.
I had this problem as well. I had to remind myself all the time that you know, I was making a movie about criminals, and I've suffered at the hands of criminals as well. I've had cars and houses broken into, and that there was quite a lot of my kind of Calvinistic upbringing came out in the fact that I was determined that they were going to pay for their crimes at the end. And we had quite a lot of kind of active debate between myself and the financiers about how many years in jail the sentence should be at the end. And I started off in the high teens. I wanted them to get 15 or 16 years, and they wanted them to get 2 years because they wanted a kind of happy ending. So we ended up compromising. I think at the moment in the movie he gets 9 years or 8 years or something. But I was quite determined, you know, that not to fall into the trap of having the criminals, you know, fall into the category of being lovable or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted them to. Well, I think it's more or less what Burt Reynolds' character teaches the kid, is that crime is, you know, is an occupation which has its penalties, and the penalties of extreme discipline and loneliness. And I was trying to create the idea that the Reynolds character was, in a way, was punishing himself for the life that he'd chosen, for the life of crime. He was punishing himself in the way that he lived a very restricted life and had virtually no social life, and didn't even enjoy spending the money that he made from crime. He would put himself on a budget, you know, using the excuse that he didn't want to splash out money and cause bring attention to himself. But these were ways that maybe psychologically he was punishing himself even without going to jail.
Your films are usually more about quirky characters than they are about elaborate plots. And I wonder why you go after that in movies.
It's just exactly what you say. I'm not interested in telling stories. I'm more interested in examining people in certain situations. And I don't like stories taking over from situation, if I can make that distinction, because if an audience is led into following a story, then they really don't have time to... They're spending most of their attention following the story. And I'm much more interested in people being able to spend time, you know, working out what the characters are doing and how the characters are reacting to each other and to the situations they're in, and just commenting on things rather than chasing a story from A to B. I think we use I think we use stories too much in our lives. You know, from the time that we're kids, we're virtually taught that life is a story with a beginning and a middle and a new, and hopefully a happy ending. And I'm just virtually doing everything I can to subvert that view of life and certainly that view of movies.
Would you say that there are certain kinds of characters that interest you most?
Well, to pick up your term, yeah, I think marginal characters interest me, but I think you said the same thing. We're all marginal to a greater or lesser degree. And obviously in movies you tend to, you tend to highlight things more than in real life. And so if you're wanting to deal with marginality, you'll deal with criminals or people who live an actively marginal life. But I think virtually we all lead that life anyway. We're all, removed from, the real world in certain ways. So I'm just trying to get at some kind of sense of realness all the time.
Well, I want to talk with you about being one of the few people in the Scottish film industry, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Bill Forsyth, and his new movie is called Breaking In. He also directed Housekeeping, Local Hero, and Comfort and Joy. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Screenwriter and director Bill Forsyth is my guest. In some ways, it seems that you are the Scottish film industry. Your first feature film, That Sinking Feeling, was also the first feature film that came out, the first fiction feature film that came out of Scotland that was made by a Scottish film director. You must have learned a lot of things the hard way, working in a country in which there virtually was no film industry.
I suppose so. I can't really recollect the pain of it though. But I suppose we might have learned things the hard way, and maybe we learned things the wrong way. Because this is one of the frustrations of being a filmmaker is that you never really have the opportunity to observe anyone else working. You know, film directors aren't the kind of people who like other film directors hanging around when they're rehearsing or shooting. So. It's a very lonely occupation, and when you go to see a movie in the cinema, you're seeing the outcome of the work rather than the work itself. So I continually find myself wondering what other people do when they make films and whether I'm doing it entirely the wrong way.
Well, is there anything that you've come to figure out actually is the wrong way, even though it really works for you?
There's one problem about making movies, and that is it's just occurred to me quite recently. The whole business of acting, when you're making a movie, you're trying to present the idea that things are happening to these people and they're reacting to them, hopefully without telling too much of a story. But what you do before that is the actors read the script, and so they know what's going to happen to them before it happens to them. So most of the rehearsal process is really a way of disguising the fact that they know what's going to happen to them.
Well, you worked with non-actors on your first film. I mean, they were involved in the Glasgow Youth Theatre, but they were there because they were unemployed teenagers, not necessarily because they were seeking out an acting profession. Did you learn a lot from working with untrained actors, also young untrained actors?
Yes, the interesting thing was, you were right, I used them, A, because they were cheap, and B, because they didn't know any better than I how to go about making a movie, and so I wouldn't feel like a fool. I felt that I had so little experience that if I'd worked with real actors, they would have seen how little I knew. But the strange thing was that working with the kids and then subsequently working with professional actors, there's no difference in the way that they behaved. The kids required the same things from me as actors like Burt Reynolds and Burt Lancaster, have. It's quite a strange thing to realise that. But just a sense of realness. I think an actor just wants to feel some security in the sense that the director feels something is happening and something real is happening, and that's all they really want of you, is that sense of security.
Have your movies in any way changed the fledgling Scottish film industry? Are there more Scottish filmmakers now, and is the government trying to help support the film industry?
Not really, no. We have a tough time with the government that we have at the moment in terms of all the arts. Everything's, all the social programmes are being cut back as well, so there's very little money for any kind of luxuries like filmmaking. this, not because of what I've done, but just because of the kind of generation that I belong to. The film business in Scotland has grown up. Scotland used to be a place that people had to leave. I think I belong to the first generation of Scots people who didn't actually leave the country, because up until then, you had to go either to London or abroad to make a go of anything. But my generation, most of the people that I know have made a go of staying there, and so that's really why the industry has grown up. It's incidental that I'm part of it. So there are just 10 times more people living and working in Scotland in the film business than there were, you know, when I started out. But it doesn't really have a lot to do with me.
My guest is film director and screenwriter Bill Forsyth, and his movies include Local Hero, Housekeeping, Comfort and Joy, and the new film Breaking In, which stars Burt Reynolds. I want to ask you a few things about your film Local Hero. And this was about a representative from a U.S. oil company who goes to a village in Scotland and tries to buy out the place in order to set up a refinery there. So in a way, the movie was about seeing this village in Scotland through the eyes of an American, and the Scottish people seeing the American and reacting to his behavior. Were there things that you were consciously trying to show about Scotland in that movie?
I think so. It wasn't perceived as such in Scotland anyway, or in Britain. Maybe more so in the States. But I was trying to subvert the kind of screen image of Scotland that did exist, by trying to demystify the kind of Brigadoon type image of Scotland. But the problem is, and the problem was, that to do that you have to use the same material that existed in these kind of movies, and so it's difficult to subvert something when you actually have to, you know, physically and visually use the same material. And so I think the subversion that was going on was too subtle for a lot of people, but I certainly was trying to undermine the cinematic image that Scotland had at the time.
Mm-hmm. Your movie Comfort and Joy was about a middle-of-the-road morning man on the radio who's very lighthearted on the air, little middle-of-the-road jokes and everything. And he decides he wants to do something serious and gets involved in trying to make a documentary on these mafia wars in the ice cream business, and of course, all these criminals want his autograph, and they want him to dedicate Dean Martin records to their family on the air. Did you ever go through a crisis yourself about feeling like you wanted to do something more serious or be perceived as more serious as you were being perceived?
Yes, I think that movie, aspect of the movie was directly related to the fact that I was beginning to feel a bit misunderstood, because I'd made three movies which had been greeted as comedies and had been labelled, you know, charming and lyrical and wacky and various words like that, when I was trying to be much more serious in the things I was trying to say. So I think there was a little bit of frustration coming out there, yeah. But it's an age-old problem. I mean, in some aspects, that movie was similar to Preston Sturges's Sullivan's Travels, where a movie director was going through having the same problem of being misunderstood. But in both movies, the same thing happened. The guy realised that he was good at one thing and he better go on with what he was good at.
Was that the resolution you made about yourself?
No, I don't think so. I think I'm still trying. I think the movies I make now are kind of less ingratiating. I think the earlier movies I was trying to maybe please too much, and that's why the humour got in the way. I've always tried to be, I'm a very kind of serious person, and I've always tried to, you know, say serious things in my movies, but I was too cute in the way that I was saying these serious things. So I think the serious side of me is more apparent now.
Did you write all the jingles yourself for Comfort and Joy?
I wrote the words. I didn't write the music. I had a friend who actually ran the local radio station write the jingles, yeah, but I wrote the words.
The words, it was like Thrifty Pops.
Thrifty Pops, yeah, you just munch them all day, they never stop.
Did you grow up seeing a lot of movies?
Not really, no, I didn't. I wasn't much of a moviegoer. When I was very young, I went through a period when I was perhaps between, you know, about 19, 23, 24, about 3 or 4 years when I began to watch movies more seriously and caught up with a lot of things. But strangely enough, after that, it kind of tailed off again, and I'm not much of a moviegoer now either.
So you're really more interested in making than in watching movies?
Yeah, Yeah, I don't get a lot of satisfaction out of watching movies.
I wonder why that is. Why you enjoy making them so much and not get the same? I don't mean the same, but not get satisfaction watching them.
Yeah, I don't know. Most times I feel kind of manipulated, and when I'm watching a movie, I just think that I'm being kind of, you know, I'm being kind of beaten around the head with ideas rather than being, you know, ideas being, you know, laid before me for my, you know, for me to pick and choose. I think that's the frustration, really.
So have the frustrations you felt as a filmgoer affected how you write and direct your movies?
Yes, they have. I feel continually subversive. I mean, I think that I really am a kind of underground. Maybe that's too grand a term, but I think I certainly feel subversive in everything I do, and virtually at every stage in the filmmaking process, I kind of ask myself the question, you know, how can I subvert, this situation or this scene, you know, and how can I make it less like a real movie, and that's a continual preoccupation with me. Yes.
I don't think this is a very fertile time for subversiveness in the American cinema. Did you have any troubles, any problems doing what you wanted to do on your new film, Breaking In?
Yes, I would say that, yes. And not troubles that were taken care of. I mean, I'm fairly happy with the result, but you must understand also it was the first movie that I made virtually within the American studio system, or maybe just on the periphery of it. And so I was exposed to lots of things that I'd never been exposed to, the marketing aspects of a movie, the previewing, and the need for cast, for name casting, and these were kind of very energy sapping things. But there are things that most American movie makers have to go through on a daily basis.
Would you do it again? Would you make another movie in America and subject yourself to the kind of committee decision making?
Yes, I would. Yes, because I survived it, and the movie, to a large extent, has survived it. And it's not. I don't feel precious about making movies. If you're asking someone to spend, you know, upwards of $7 million, you know, on your movie, then you obviously have to take, you have to take into consideration that the amount of money that's being laid out. But there are ways of coping with it. I mean, I'm just at the very beginning of perhaps that aspect of my career as a filmmaker, the aspect of being able to cope with these things and turn them to your advantage.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about movies. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Bill Forsyth, and he directed the new film Breaking In, which stars Burt Reynolds. The screenplay was written by John Sayles. Bill Forsyth is also a screenwriter. The earlier films that he wrote and directed include Comfort and Joy, Local Hero, Gregory's Girl, and Housekeeping, which was also based on a novel, but he adapted the novel for the screen. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be humorist and columnist Russell Baker, whose latest memoir is on the bestseller list. I hope you can join us. This is a scene from Bill Forsyth's movie Comfort and Joy. Dickie Bird, the morning DJ, is in the studio recording voiceovers for jingles.
The big bag of munchies, and last the whole day.
Thrifty Pops, Thrifty Pops, you just munch them all day, they never stop.
Thrifty Pops, I want them now.
Thrifty Pops, the big, big bag of munchies that lasts all day.
Well, it was a bit dry, maybe.
All right, spin it again.
Thrifty Pops, the big, big bag of munchies that lasts the whole day.
Thrifty Pops, you just eat them all day, they never stop.
Oh, no, Thrifty no. Pops. You said eat, Alan. It should be munch.
Oh,
it's a big, big bag of munchies that lasts the whole day.
Thrifty Pops, you just munch them all day, they never stop. Cut.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Vladimir Nabokov wrote letters to his editors, to book critics, to fellow writers, friends, and family. Those letters have been collected in a new book edited by his son Dmitri. Coming up, Dmitri Nabokov reads us some of the letters his father wrote to him. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new David Bowie CD collection. It includes previously unreleased versions of such Bowie classics as Space Oddity. And we find out about the martial arts film star people are calling the next Bruce Lee. Owen Gleiberman reviews Bloodsport, the 1987 film, which introduced Jean-Claude Van Damme to martial arts fans. It's out on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A tense East Germany celebrated its 40th anniversary today, with Soviet leader Gorbachev among those present to lend his support. NPR's Mike Schuster in Berlin has more.
Gorbachev caused excitement today wherever he went in East Berlin. At one point, he approached a cheering crowd, and the Soviet leader had some advice for the East Germans. "Don't panic," he said. "Stay calm, and stay rather than leave," a reference to the thousands of East Germans who have fled to the West in the past month. Some in the crowd chanted, "We're staying." All was calm for the celebrations in East Berlin today, but church sources report that riot police are patrolling the streets of many East German cities. There appears to have been three straight nights of unrest in Dresden, and in Magdeburg, 600 people marched silently after a prayer service. 200 were reported arrested. East Germany's anniversary celebrations end tomorrow. I'm Mike Schuster in Berlin.
At a Communist Party Congress in Hungary, party leaders said that communism is no longer on the agenda. The remarks by party chairman Rezsu Nezs came at the opening of a three-day meeting where the Hungarian Communist Party will determine its future. NPR's Deborah Amos in Budapest filed this report.
If the proposal of Hungary's Communist Party president is accepted, it would mark a radical change in the 40-year history of the Hungarian Socialist Workers' Party. His was the opening speech of a party congress. He said that communism was no longer topical in Hungary, but while he called for a new party, he said it should not embrace European socialism. This is the proposal of communist reformers who threatened to split the party. In a speech today, the party's most well-known reformer said the party must have a new name and a new image. He said it has to face the responsibility for the sins and crimes of the past. The party president's speech is seen as a balancing act, trying to find a compromise between the two wings of the party to keep unity. But there's little doubt that when the party congress ends, it will be a different party than when the congress began. In Budapest, this is Deborah Amos.
Two Burmese students demanding a return to democracy in their military-run country surrendered peacefully to Thai officials today after hijacking a Burmese airliner and threatening to blow it up. None of the 83 hostages on board the plane were injured. The two men gave up after negotiations with Thai and Burmese officials. A divided Israeli cabinet has turned down an Egyptian peace plan, calling for talks with the Palestinian delegation in Cairo. The 12 leaders of the coalition government voted along party lines and deadlocked 6-6 on the question. On Wall Street today, a fourth day of record highs, as the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 12 points, to close at 2,785.52, on volume of 173,100,000 shares. Advances led declines 7-6 in very active trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. There's a new collection of music that traces the career of the chameleon of rock, David Bowie. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Sound and Vision.
Always in trouble, never to blame. Must be a doubtful, feeling the same.
CD technology has inspired a lot of retrospective rock collections. Everyone from Eric Clapton to Jethro Tull, from the Allman Brothers to the Righteous Brothers have had their multiple-disc, digitally remastered last chance to make a killing. Some of these collections have been mere profit-raising efforts, a batch of greatest hits with a few obscurities thrown in to make the hefty price tag irresistible to the collector. Ryko Disc's new David Bowie collection, Sound and Vision, fits that description, but it's different. It attempts to give shape and weight to a singularly shapeless, weightless career.
intro to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on.
10 ground control to Major Tom.
8 7 6.
That's the original demo version of what is probably Bowie's best-known song. It was recorded in Bowie's bedroom in 1969, with Bowie playing the stylophone, an early variation on the synthesizer, and accompanied by John Hutchinson on guitar. By the early 70s, Bowie would be a joltingly original star, one of the performers who announced a break with the previous decade of rock and roll attitude. In the face of the hippie era's sincerity, engagement, and generosity, Bowie offered irony, distance, and self-absorption. Early Bowie favorites like Changes, The Man Who Sold the World, and Panic in Detroit, all included on Sound and Vision, announced the arrival of a new counterculture, a generation of overdressed pessimists, of androgynous naysayers who sneered and batted their eyelashes as a matter of pop cultural prerogative. Bowie was campy and arty, but he was also an aggressive rock and roller.
London nights are dark, strange young town. London nights are dark, brought me down. Don't like your new face, that's not nice. Got to go far, far. London nights are dark. Gee, 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 take me away. Gee, 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 take me today. The boys are the glow shops, only curry for a pound. This carpet is a soggy, and the ceiling's on the ground. I love dark, I love town.
That's a previously unreleased 1970 track called London by Tata. Sound and Vision contains 46 songs, and the CD version of the package, perhaps in an attempt to justify the $59.98 price tag, includes a video disc featuring the tediously surreal video for the 1980 song Ashes to Ashes, yet another reason for not buying a video disc player. All of this is just the first stage of Ryko Disc's Bowie project. Starting early next year, the company will be releasing all 18 of Bowie's RCA albums on CD. As someone who admires Bowie's oddness and adventurousness more than I actually play his old albums, it's this Sound and Vision collection that I find most useful. I'll never want to sit through the entire CD of, say, Aladdin Sane, but I can easily imagine putting on this set, which follows a terrific song like Changes, with this typically peculiar version of Chuck Berry's Round and Round. Until now, it's only been available as a B-side single.
About 12 o'clock, well, the place was packed. The front doors were locked. I said, the place is packed. When the police knocked, those doors flew back. Rockin' on rockin', round and round and round. Yeah, real man rockin', wanna be the sound. Well, they're not rockin', feel the room is down. Yeah.
That's David Bowie sounding like John Lennon imitating Paul McCartney doing his Little Richard impersonation on a Chuck Berry song. Pretty cool, huh? Or how about this, Bowie's previously unreleased 1975 version of a Bruce Springsteen song, It's Hard to Be a Saint in the City.
I was the king of the island, mama. I could talk some trash. I was the prince of the paupers, crowned downtown at the beggar's bash. I was a pimp's main prophet. I kept everything cool. Just a backstreet gambler with a love to lose. And when the heat came down, it was left on the ground. And the devil appeared to me like Jesus through the steam in the street. And showed me a hand that even the cops couldn't beat. And I felt his hot breath on my neck as I dove into the heat. It's so hard to be a saint when you're just a boy out on the street.
By choosing the music that was at once Bowie's most adventurous yet most disciplined, Sound and Vision makes a case for David Bowie as a vital pop innovator whose creativity peaked at the end of the 70s. These days, Bowie is trying to scare up listeners for the scarily desperate music he's making as part of the band Tin Machine. As an innovator, he's dead. But Sound and Vision embalms him in the most attractive manner possible.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Alice, very sweet, always eats the meat. Joey comes on strong, make
fresh air. One of this century's greatest writers in the English language was the Russian-born Vladimir Nabokov. His letters to family, friends, editors, publishers, and fellow writers are collected in a new book. The book is edited by his son Dmitri and his former student Matthew Brookeley. The letters date to the time Nabokov and his family arrived in the United States in 1940, to his death in Switzerland in 1977. Many of the letters concern the difficulty he had publishing his best-known novel, Lolita. The book was controversial in its time because it's about a middle-aged man's obsession with a 12-year-old nymphette. I asked Dmitri Nabokov if his father would have wanted his letters published.
I know that father wrote most of his letters with the same precision, the precision of the artist and the passion of the scientist, because he was aware, as he was of many things, that what he wrote would go down in the record. When he was first writing Lolita, he referred to it in writing to one of his correspondents as a time bomb, so he had an inkling of what might happen, even though later he almost destroyed the book. So I think that he would have probably not disapproved the project. He might have edited it differently, but I hope not.
There are many letters in this collection about Lolita. Let me ask you to read a letter about Lolita that was written in 1956 about why he really didn't think anyone could possibly seriously see the book as being pornographic.
This letter was written to Professor Morris Bishop of Cornell, who was single-handedly instrumental in having father come to Cornell as a professor and was his only intimate friend on campus. The letter written on 6 March 1956 reads partially as follows. I calmly lean on my conviction that it is a serious work of art and that no court could prove it to be, quote, lewd and libertine, unquote. All categories grade, of course, into one another. A comedy of manners written by a fine poet may have its lewd side, but Lolita is a tragedy. Pornography, quote unquote, is not an image plucked out of context. Pornography is an attitude and an intention. The tragic and the obscene exclude each other.
There's a letter about Lolita that was written to you by your father, who was pretty angry about something that you were participating in. This concerned the casting of the movie Lolita. And do you want to explain what you were doing and then read the letter about it?
Somewhat shamefacedly, yes. In my early years in Milan, I went to complete my singing studies and then to make my debut. In Milano, I became friendly with a somewhat suspect publicity agent who talked me into the following scheme. Lolita was just having a big play in the press in Italy. The Italian translation had come out, and there was talk of the film, which Stanley Kubrick was preparing in America. The idea was this, that we would have a Lolita contest held at my apartment in Milan with a jury of my fellow opera singers, many of them from La Scala, including people like Anna Moffo, who gamely participated in this. With, of course, a predetermined winner, who was a lovely little ballerina at La Scala, and a good time to be had by all and to be covered by the Italian newsreels of the time. Being in my 20s, adventurous and fond of pretty girls, I said, okay, let's do it. Bad mistake. At dawn, provincial mothers with decidedly post-pubescent nymphets in tow started arriving at my house. I had no idea what to do with them. Finally, I found myself with this procession of candidates and everybody having a great time. And a few days later, my father saw in a Paris magazine his son surrounded by other buxom girls in a huge satin-covered bed, all clothed, all decent, but still. He had kept far away from casting matters. In fact, when he didn't know how the thing would be cast. He he didn't envisage having a 12-year-old girl play Lolita then. Maybe now he would have. He thought at one point, as he wrote in one of his letters, that perhaps she should be played by a dwarfess. When he saw this, he wrote me a rather indignant telegram followed by the letter which I will now read you. My dear, this comes, by the way, from Mandeville Canyon Road in Los Angeles, where he had been completing work on the script. Today I sent you a telegram asking you to stop the, quote, Lolita publicity, unquote, and would like to say the following to you. This publicity is in very bad taste. It can only harm you in the eyes of those who take music seriously. It has already harmed me. Because of it, I cannot come to Italy, since the reporters would immediately pounce on me there, and I would have to deny categorically everything that you or your agent have been saying. Here, I have resolutely kept my distance from the search for an actress and from all casting matters. This was in the interest of my reputation and also in that of the producer. I cannot tell you how unpleasant, repugnant even, I find the reports in the Italian press linking you with a presumed search for an actress who has, incidentally, long since been found by Kubrick and Harris. No less important is that this unhealthy ruckus can only dilute your young fame.
Were there other ways that you felt you were used by...
I'm pretty good at not being used. This was kind of fun, and I was the guilty party here.
Right.
I pretty well take care of myself, and he was absolutely right, although he was such a nice, indulgent father that he quickly forgave me, and we had many good laughs over the thing afterwards.
In one of the letters, your father writes to you what he calls an instructive little jingle. Would you recite that jingle for us and explain why he wrote it?
In Italy, for his own good, a wolf should wear a riding hood. I think it's even more cogent in these days of dread diseases, but even then, my parents were rather concerned that... being a vigorous bachelor, I might pick up the wrong thing from the wrong girl.
Hence the riding hood. Okay.
It shows you, you know, how humorous and warm he was even in little things like that. He was a great father. We had laughs about everything.
Were you very self-conscious when you were growing up about speaking or about writing? You know, because your father was so precise with his language and also so funny with his use of it and so creative with it. I mean, his books are filled with puns and anagrams and complex wordplay. Did it make you self-conscious about just being able to speak extemporaneously?
I'll begin by commenting on speaking extemporaneously. When I was in prep school, I loved speaking and debating. Besides, that was one way of getting out of school for a weekend, that and sports. I was on the debating team, on the public speaking team, on the extemporaneous and impromptu speaking squad, and I won a New Hampshire and a New England championship in those things because I enjoyed doing it very much. That was long before I became delicately and intimately conscious of the intricacies of my father's style. However, what I can say is that he never made me self-conscious. He allowed me to collaborate both in the translations and sometimes in revising and checking and proofreading. He checked some of my early, very naive attempts at fiction and poetry. He never became an ogre, a monster, an overwhelming, frightening figure. He was always indulgent and nice and not overly critical and helped me along. I can also say this, that I think that the apprenticeship that I almost subliminally had with Father over the years, plus the supreme legacy that he gave me at his death, oddly, that of inspiration, was instrumental in changing my life completely and in making me switch from my beloved career of singing to a priority given to literature now.
What are you referring to when you say the legacy that your father left you at his death?
Well, besides the apprenticeship of having worked under the discipline that he always imposed and which I loved, the legacy is an almost intangible thing. After his death, it was as if an obscure, intangible soul of his writing had been at least partially transmitted to me, because I suddenly found myself writing original English, something I had never done before. I can't make it any more precise than that.
Mm-hmm. I heard that you're writing a novel, but under a pen name.
I'm writing a novel which is fairly complex, not an imitation of Vladimir Nabokov.
Why are you writing it under a pen name?
To avoid undeserved fame and undeserved blame.
Well, are you under this kind of pressure of, you should really be a genius, your father was?
Maybe I should be, but that's not for me to judge. However, I can say this. I think an engineer's son or a businessman's son is expected to take over the trade, and they're often very brilliant successors to their fathers. In the arts, a son somehow is very vulnerable. He's vulnerable to attack, and he's also vulnerable to being given the illusion that he's good when he's not, simply because he's his father's son. So if the thing flies on its own wings, maybe I'll paint the correct name on the tail.
I thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Dmitri Nabokov is the co-editor of a new collection of letters written by his father, Vladimir Nabokov. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll be hearing about Panama again. And was there a foul-up at the White House in trying to handle the coup attempt in Panama? Also, news of East Germany's 40th birthday celebrations and what Mikhail Gorbachev had to say to East Berliners today. We'll also be hearing about a man from Washington, D.C., who became a friend to the homeless and how he became one. And about Neil Young's new album. Linda Wertheimer talks with rock critic David Frick.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Late Bruce Lee was the first of the martial arts film megastars. One of his most popular successors, Jean-Claude Van Damme, has a new movie out called Kickboxer. But the film that put Van Damme on the map was Bloodsport. It's just been released on home video. Critic Owen Gleiberman has a review.
There used to be a popular kid's toy called Rock'em Sock'em Robots. You and a friend sat around a miniature boxing ring and controlled two plastic square-headed humanoids. The idea was to knock the other guy's block off. Jean-Claude Van Damme is basically a Rock'em Sock'em robot. He's the new martial arts superstar, the latest musclehead to hold the crown once worn by Bruce Lee and Chuck Norris. How do they decide which of these steroid cases get to become actors? It must be natural selection. Whoever has a perfect build and the mental agility to memorize two lines of dialogue in a row gets the job. Van Damme, who's Dutch, first came to prominence in the 1987 movie Bloodsport. He's made two films since then, including the recently released Kickboxer, but neither one has packed as big a wallop. Bloodsport is based on the career of Frank Dukes, an American who went undefeated in 329 matches and still holds many scary-sounding records, such as fastest kick with knockout, 72 miles per hour. In the movie, Van Damme journeys to Hong Kong to compete in the Kumite, a treacherous tournament in which one quick blow can send you to your maker.
Why are you fighting in it?
It's personal.
You want to prove your manhood to the world?
The Kumite is for the fighters, not for the people who read newspapers.
But I've heard that it's unnecessarily brutal. Like a cockfight, except it's with people.
Bloodsport is a kind of low-rent karate kid. Our hero is trained by a poker-faced Oriental master, and there's plenty of the usual Zen blather about mind over body. Van Damme uses his mental discipline to crush bricks, do a split between two chairs, and fend off blows while blindfolded. The force is most definitely with him. In the end, he squares off against the Kumite's defending champ, a brute with a chest the size of an RCA television console.
What's going on?
It's Zhang Li, the current champ.
He's never been defeated. Those awesome records, including the fastest kill. He killed a guy during the last Kumite.
Yep, kicked the poor bastard right in the throat. I died right there on the platform. Zhang Li stood there and watched him die.
The fight scenes in Bloodsport should satisfy anyone's appetite for socially unredeeming violence. Yet something is missing. The late Bruce Lee had as many moves as Van Damme does, but he also had a roguish, demonic charm. Van Damme is so pretty and nonchalant, he's more like the Tom Cruise of martial arts. He's a kinder, gentler karate machine. Unlike Schwarzenegger, Stallone, or any of the other 80s action heroes, Van Damme doesn't even pretend to get mad. He's really an abstraction of a fighter hero. Bloodsport delivers the goods, all right, but as dazzling as Van Damme's moves are, you can tell he's just going through the motions.
Owen Gleiberman is a Boston-based writer and critic. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers. Naomi Person produces our reviews. They're edited and mixed by Roberta Sharrock, Joan Tui, and Karen Impola. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Russell Baker tells us how he gave up political reporting for political humor. And we'll hear about the 50th anniversary of a milestone in jazz history, tenor saxophonist Coleman Hawkins' recording of Body and Soul. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.
It's the last dance this evening.